Welcome to the Expert Speak, a service of the Florida Psychiatric Society. I'm Abby Strauss, and thanks for listening.
Stuart Isaacson is a neurologist who treats and has done a fair amount of research in movement disorders. He kindly joins us today to talk about tardive dyskinesia. Thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Delighted to be here.
In the last year or so, there have been growing discussions in the public media about a new medication that treats the side effects of other medications, the side effect being, in particular, tardive dyskinesia. Many questions come up about what this condition is and what we really can do to prevent it, or do we need to just accommodate our lives around it? And one of the questions that comes up is, do we take away the medicine that is causing the side effect because of the side effect, or do we leave that as a baseline? So let's start with some basic definitions, please. The side effect is known as tardive dyskinesia. What is it? What causes it? Give us an overview, please.
Tardive dyskinesia is a movement disorder. It involves involuntary movements. It's a movement disorder that arises as a late effect of medications that block dopamine receptors and was initially recognized with the advent of neuroleptics. Antipsychotics were approved for treating psychoses such as schizophrenia. The idea of a tardive effect, the word tardive reflects not an acute side effect such as a dystonic reaction that might occur after the first dose or two, or a subacute effect, the drug-induced Parkinsonism from blocking dopamine D2 receptors. Tardive reflects something that occurs later, after weeks or months or years of blocking dopamine receptors for some reason. And we're not really sure and understand the reason, but we think it reflects some propensity of some patients to get this overactivation, perhaps an upregulation of postsynaptic D2 dopamine receptors that is a consequence of blocking those receptors chronically with dopamine-blocking agents like antipsychotics, antiemetics, gastric dysmotility agents. When we think about tardive dyskinesia, it's a disorder that occurs weeks, months, or years after chronic exposure to something that blocks a dopamine receptor, and nothing else causes it. It's always going to be a medication that a patient has been exposed to that blocks these dopamine receptors.
Does everybody get it?
And that's really a perplexing thing. We know that about 30% of patients who are exposed to the first generation antipsychotics develop tardive dyskinesia at some point in the course. Probably around 7% of patients who are exposed only to an atypical second generation antipsychotic will develop tardive dyskinesia. And we don't know why it's those numbers. 7% is about 1 in 14 people. Perhaps it reflects a genetic predisposition that these receptors have as a response to being blocked by an antipsychotic or other dopamine-blocking agent. We don't know why some people get it and some don't. We are aware of a number of risk factors, though, that place patients at higher risk of developing tardive dyskinesia. This, of course, includes the potency and receptor occupancy of the antipsychotic, the length of duration of treatment, but also patient-specific things such as older age, female sex, and some characteristics that include drugs of abuse, use of amphetamines, mood disorders. All of these can increase the risk of developing a tardive dyskinesia, but there probably is a unrecognized to date genetic predisposition as well, I would suspect, perhaps in that dopamine receptor or modulators of the dopamine receptor.
If someone is on one of these, we'll just limit right now to the antipsychotics. There are other classes of drugs that can cause it. But if we stop the medicine, does the tardive dyskinesia go away or does it get less intense? What happens if we stop the antipsychotic?
Well, it really is something that we have not thought so much about in years past because we really didn't have treatment options for these patients. So as a movement disorder neurologist, we often would point the finger directly at that dopamine-blocking antipsychotic and suggest lowering the dose or stopping the medicine or switching to something else. But it really misses the underlying point that people with mental health issues who have psychoses and other indications that these antipsychotics are now approved for, these antipsychotics are indeed life-changing, if not life-saving medications. And they're essential for people who need to take them. So I think once a patient develops tardive dyskinesia and is taking an antipsychotic, we know that this condition is not reversible. It can become more or less based on different things that occur in a patient's life and medications they're exposed to, but it never really goes away. So we can't just stop the antipsychotic and think that we're going to resolve the problem. And if an antipsychotic has already been optimized, maybe it's the third or fourth one, maybe it's the one that works best, balancing efficacy and tolerability, we don't look to change the antipsychotic. We're also aware that, different than in drug-induced Parkinsonism, lowering the antipsychotic in a patient with tardive dyskinesia causes a temporary increase in the movement. As we remove some of the blockade of these receptors, the movements actually increase with a lower dose for a time before they might settle down. And paradoxically, when we raise the dose of an antipsychotic, temporarily, there might be a reduction in the presence of the tardive dyskinesia involuntary movements, but then they return at a greater degree. Rather than looking at these necessary and optimized drugs in patients who need to take the antipsychotic, we have to think about other therapeutic ways of trying to treat that movement disorder of tardive dyskinesia without looking specifically at a medication that's already been optimized. Now, of course, if the antipsychotic or other dopamine-blocking drug was used casually and does not need to be used or is not an optimized dose or formulation or medication, that's different. But when a patient is being seen thoughtfully by a psychiatrist or other specialist, the drug has been chosen and optimized, and the patient has had clinical improvement, we want to treat the tardive dyskinesia and not alter that antipsychotic.
One of the things that's very confusing, and one of the reasons that I'm so pleased that you're here to talk about this, is that the class of medications initially known as antipsychotic has fallen into a new label called mood stabilizer. They are used for bipolar disorder and in affective disorders, in particular depression. Many people are taking these medications appropriately most of the time, thank goodness. But the notion of it being so widely used in a whole new domain is troubling. Are we seeing an increase in the incidence? Are we seeing an increase in the prevalence of tardive dyskinesia for mood disorders as opposed to the traditional use of antipsychotics, which was for, well, schizophrenia or other psychoses? Complicated question, I'm sorry, but your thoughts on that?
You know, these classes of antipsychotic drugs really go to the heart of the blocking dopamine receptors. And all currently available antipsychotics, except for the Parkinson's antipsychotic pimavanserin, and all others block postsynaptic D2 receptors and can cause drug-induced Parkinsonism, tardive dyskinesia, and they also have multiple other receptor affinities and occupancies that lead to off-target side effects. And we're always trying to balance the efficacy, safety, and tolerability of all medicines, and especially this class of medications. And patients have to be apprised of the risks and the potential benefits of any medication. Now that there's an expanded indications, it's led to two issues. One, so many more patients are exposed to these dopamine-blocking agents, and studies are often done for 6 months in a blinded fashion. So we don't have a lot of long-range data to really understand if patients who are treated for a mood disorder, which we know is a risk factor for developing tardive dyskinesia, will continue to have a 1 in 14 develop tardive dyskinesia, or if this number will be higher or lower in the non-psychosis population. So we don't know that fully, but if they're being used so much more commonly, so much more frequently, that the number of people with tardive dyskinesia, both diagnosed and underrecognized, is growing substantially. It also brings in the other problem that's faced with these expanded indications. Patients are often not aware that they're taking a, quote, antipsychotic, but rather they may think they're taking a mood-stabilizing drug or an antidepressant when they're used as adjunctive therapy, and may not even be aware of some of the risks or of the monitoring that needs to be done. I think it's really going to be important that when these drugs are used, which are effective medications, that we apprise patients of the benefits and the risks of the therapies, both short-term and long-term.
You use the word monitor, and that's a critical issue. One of the things that is a clinical issue is to separate tardive dyskinesia from extrapyramidal syndrome, symptoms that we used to treat with Cogentin. They're two different entities. It has to be carefully looked at and diagnosed and considered. What are the signs of tardive dyskinesia? And in a sense, could you give us an overview of something like the AIMS scale? What is that all about?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very good question. I think it goes to the heart of this idea of how we capture and study side effects, adverse events, and such. I like to think about the efficacy of antipsychotics is being related to dopamine D2 blockade in the first generation and a combination, of course, of dopamine D2 blockade and serotonin 2A receptor antagonism in the second generation drugs. And we look forward to non-dopaminergic drugs hopefully becoming approved in the coming years. Think about blockade of these receptors and the off-target receptors. I think about side effects as off-target receptors being blocked or activated. When we think about these dopamine D2 receptor problems, I like to think about them not as side effects per se, but as a consequence. There's a benefit of blocking D2 receptors in psychoses and perhaps other indications, but there's also a consequence. The consequence with the first couple of doses could be an acute dystonic reaction. The consequence subacutely could be you block the dopamine receptors and reduce mobility and develop drug-induced Parkinsonism, the essence of which is a paucity of movement, too little movement, not blinking the eyes, lower voice, slow walking and posture being stooped, slower movements overall, and a rest tremor that can emerge in the tongue, the jaw, the hands, or the feet. This idea of blocking dopamine receptors having too little movement is very different than what happens in a tardive syndrome, like tardive dyskinesia, where after weeks or months or years, and the APA points out that in elderly people, it could be as soon as 4 weeks, you get, instead of too little dopamine activation with too little movement, you get an overactivation of the dopamine system with too much movement. And these people who have tardive dyskinesia never stop moving. They're constantly moving. They're moving muscles in their upper and lower face, in their shoulders and trunk, in their arms and fingers and legs and toes. They're always moving. So there's a very big difference between those with too little movement and drug-induced Parkinsonism from dopamine receptor blockade and too little movement, and those with tardive dyskinesia never stop moving and overactivity of the dopaminergic pathways and too much. And the AIMS scale is a validated scale that can be used both for screening for tardive dyskinesia and also for evaluating over time the stability or an increase or decrease in the tardive dyskinesia movements or treatment responses. Because the AIMS scale looks specifically with four items at the face and then head, and then items that involve the trunk and shoulders, and items that involve the arms and legs. And it adds up to a score. It's a fairly simplistic scale that can be used casually, I like to say, with 0 to 4, 0 being normal, 1 being could be normal, and then 2, 3, 4 being mild, moderate, severe to describe the movements in that part of the body. Or it can be done formally as we do in our research programs. And there are all sorts of videos online and different websites that can instruct in a formal way of evaluating a patient to get these numbers as well. But when you add them up, you get a total score. And somewhere above a 15 or so in that range, you begin to see more movements in patients. The patients typically go into research programs and have the improvement that's described with approved therapies. You point out Cogentin is sometimes used for drug-induced Parkinsonism. So it's important to recognize that when you diagnose drug-induced Parkinsonism with too little movement, anticholinergics are appropriate therapy and can be helpful, but they may worsen tardive dyskinesia. Distinguishing between a patient with too little movement and too much movement can have therapeutic implications. One risk factor I didn't point out earlier is that people who have had drug-induced Parkinsonism are at higher risk of developing tardive dyskinesia later. So perhaps someone is on a first-generation neuroleptic, they develop drug-induced Parkinsonism, it's treated with an anticholinergic like Cogentin, and now it's some years later, they're now no longer on the first-generation neuroleptic, they've been switched to a second-generation antipsychotic, they may still be on Cogentin, the drug-induced Parkinsonism may be better, no longer from the Cogentin, but now because they're on a less dopamine receptor occupancy antipsychotic and an atypical. And in those patients, we always want to be looking, if they're on Cogentin, do they still have drug-induced Parkinsonism that's being treated, or do they now have tardive dyskinesia? Because then we would want to not look towards an anticholinergic. We'd want to, over time, try to withdraw that medicine and then think about treating the tardive dyskinesia.
Which is the perfect segue to the fact that, yes, we have something that we can treat the tardive with. When I was a resident, I'm sure with you as well, we didn't have this type of drug. Tardive dyskinesias, they were somewhat unfortunate, if not a scary diagnosis. It was a horrible trade-off at times. We have two medicines on the market now, one called Ingrezza and one called Austedo. Give us an overview of those and
a little bit of history so people can understand what they do and how we use them and how fortunate we are to have them.
It's really an interesting situation. For so many decades, we've really not had any truly effective medication, certainly none with regulatory approval, and suddenly we have two. But patients have this disorder. We know it's associated with D2 dopamine receptor blockade. The consequences for having this disorder have been described now, and their impact on patients in both social, psychological, and their mental health, and their social and employment and schooling and recreational activities. So it's something that we're grateful to have some choices therapeutically, trying to decide who's a candidate for these medications, look and diagnose the movement, and then identify the impact it's having. The APA suggests that patients who have moderate to severe impact from tardive dyskinesia should be treated first line with one of these VMAT2 inhibitors, and even those with mild impact, mild movements, but it impacts their daily life should be treated as well first line with the VMAT2 inhibitor. And that's what INGREZZA and AUSTEDO, the brand names of these two medicines, INGREZZA being valbenazine, AUSTEDO being deutetrabenazine, inhibit a transporter called vesicular monoamine transporter 2, VMAT2, abbreviated. And this is how dopamine gets from the cell body, the cytosol, into synaptic vesicles within the neuron, the presynaptic nigrostriatal dopamine neuron. Dopamine enters through this transporter. It packs up these synaptic vesicles, these little bags carrying this neurochemical. And when there's an action potential, they migrate towards the synapse. There's exocytosis. They're exposed into the synapse. Dopamine can travel to postsynaptic dopamine D2 receptors and cause activation. Of course, if there's an antipsychotic blocking those receptors, dopamine can't be as effective. And that's why some patients develop drug-induced Parkinsonism. In tardive dyskinesia, there's many more receptors, too many receptors, we think, that are overactive. So now you release dopamine and it binds to these overactive receptors, making them even more active. A VMAT2 inhibitor prevents some dopamine from getting into those synaptic vesicles. So when there's an action potential, less dopamine is released at the synapse and less dopamine is available to increase the activities of these overactive dopamine receptors, and movement, involuntary movement, is reduced. And that's what we think is the mechanism of action of these VMAT2 inhibitors, valbenazine and deutetrabenazine. Studied, looked at in placebo-controlled, randomized trials, and demonstrated efficacy, safety, and tolerability, and both were approved for tardive dyskinesia several years ago.
One of the things that I am confronted with, and I'm sure you are as well, and I want to preface this by saying that I have a number of patients who are on one of the antipsychotics and doing well and develop tardive dyskinesia. Often we refer to it by the initials TD. And people would say to me, do I have to take yet another pill? And the answer is, I wish you didn't. But we have to look at it from the perspective that without the antipsychotic, what would their life be like? And it's not what we want. It's not ideal. It's the best we have. We need to give people quality of life. That needs to be the discussion that somewhere along the line has to occur. Do you see the overuse, the over-cavalier quality that don't worry about the antipsychotic so much, we'll just give you another drug to control side effects? That's not the approach I believe we should have, but I'm afraid that that will happen because a lot of people are not going to get, a lot of prescribers are not going to get as involved in the psychological components of now taking two medicines, not just one.
Yes, well, it's always difficult because when we think about trying to do no harm when we prescribe medications to our patients, and we begin to think about side effects from therapies, we're always trying to balance, minimize side effects, and maintain efficacy. Tardive dyskinesia really puts a kink into that, and that's why I like to think about it not as a side effect, but as a consequence. Benefit from blocking dopamine receptors, but there's a consequence in some people. They get these extra movements, and what do we do about that? Maybe the antipsychotic's not needed. A different antipsychotic can be chosen. Maybe a lower dose can be chosen. Or maybe that's already been done and it's already been optimized, and we don't want to take a chance of a patient having a return of their schizophrenia symptoms or having a loss of follow-up or losing job or social or recreational opportunities. So we have options. I think if every antipsychotic came in two forms, one with a VMAT2 inhibitor in it and the original without it, it would be simple to switch from one to the other and give the VMAT2 inhibitor. I think the problem is the different medication, prescription, and despite their overall tolerability that's been demonstrated, it's still having to add another medicine. So I think we always want to reevaluate, is that antipsychotic needed? Is it the right antipsychotic? Is it at the right dose? And if so, is the tardive dyskinesia movement impacting a patient? And if the answer is yes, then that's when I would consider a VMAT2 inhibitor.
Thank goodness we have it. Again, I'm sure you and I could swap a lot of stories about over the years we've seen people get better, but I like the term consequence. It's so much more realistic and to the point than side effect. We need to use that term far more frequently. This has been really interesting. We could talk on and on. Stuart Isaacson is a neurologist, and he has taken us through a walk through the intricacies and the good fortune that we now have of having medications to deal with tardive dyskinesia.
It's sort of remarkable that these medicines actually work.
Dr. Isaacson, thank you so much for joining us, sir. Thank you.
Great talking to you as well.